This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by ProPax with NT-Factor, a complete vitamin and mineral formula. NT-Factor is the only nutritional formula clinically proven to reduce fatigue, whatever the cause, whether it be age, illness, or just being run down. NT-Factor repairs damaged cells, restores healthy bacteria in your digestive tract. Clinical trials have shown NT-Factor reduces fatigue by almost half, and it even reverses some symptoms of aging. I've been taking NT-Factor for years, and now the 45-day money-back guarantee, you have nothing to lose. To order, call 800-982-9158, that's 800-982-9158, or go to ntfactor.com, that's ntfactor.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we're into something that is extraordinarily timely because today, literally today, hearings are being held about the safety of breast implants. They're under federal review after reported illnesses. And no, this is not new. There has been a news cycle over the history of breast implants, which at various times have called into question their safety and alternatively exonerated them. And so this is, for many women, concerning because 400,000 women obtain breast implants on an annual basis, and a lot of women have breast implants. They have them for cosmetic purposes. They have them for reconstructive purposes after breast cancer. This is a big deal. If they can't trust the safety of these, what are after all medical devices, well, that's quite concerning. Today we're going to talk to a cosmetic and plastic surgeon who's very familiar with us. She is Dr. Sophie Bartzisch. And Dr. Bartzisch is a graduate of Columbia University. She has a medical degree at Weill Cornell Medical College. She did her plastic surgery at New York Presbyterian Hospital. She's active in the field of cosmetic breast surgery. She's also very acquainted with implant-based complications. And that is sort of a subset of breast surgery because, well, sometimes these things go wrong. And she's going to tell us what can go wrong and give us some perspective on the hearings that are now being held. Dr. Bartzisch, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us with this timely update.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so first of all, let's get a little bit of history on breast implants because I did a little research on this, and actually I have here that in 1895, Austrian-German surgeon Vincent Czerny, who's known as the father of plastic surgery. Maybe he's known to you because you did a plastic surgery residency and fellowship. He performed breast reconstruction on a woman at the University of Heidelberg. Fast forward to 1962, a couple of guys, Thomas Cronin and Frank Giroux, invented the silicone breast implant, and the rest is history, right?
That's right.
So
a very long and diverse history at that.
Indeed, because this is not the first time that breast implants have been called into question. In the 90s, there were lawsuits against Dow Corning for health issues linked to ruptured implants. And then there's been this whole controversy over silicone breast implants. So give us a little background on that, please.
Right. So, you know, there's two main categories of implants. There are the saline and the silicone. And the saline essentially is a sac that's filled with physiologic fluid or salt water, if you will, that's at a physiologic balance. And then the other option is the silicone, which are gel-filled implants. And so those are the two main categories. And there's always been a discussion around both types, but it's really the silicone that's gotten the most attention and that is being called the most into question at this point. At the time in the 90s, what was happening was there were a lot of patients who had gotten implants in the 80s, and there was a percentage of those implants, of those patients with those implants who were complaining of various kinds of problems. And The issue with it, which is still the issue today, is that these are non-specific complaints. So you can't really draw a line between the implant and exactly what the patient's complaining.
In other words, correlation is not causation, because women, we know, are prone to autoimmune diseases. Mm-hmm. And it was found that some women who had breast implants had these weird autoimmune diseases, Sjogren's syndrome and scleroderma and even lupus. Right. And then they did a statistical analysis and they said, we're going to exonerate the breast implants. Just because they happen to occur in women, these problems occur in women who've had the breast implants, does not imply a direct linkage. Is that
right?
Fair summation?
That's a fair summation. And you know, it's a combination of the fact that you can't really make a direct link. There's no specific blood test or vital sign that says this is an implant problem. And then there's also the fact that this entity that's now being termed breast implant-associated illness is in of itself a difficult thing to describe or prove. And sometimes it's not a specific autoimmune disease. Sometimes it's just, I don't feel so great.
Yeah.
I'm a little tired
all
the time.
It's vague, right.
Yeah, and what do you really do with that, and how do you figure out with everything else that you have going on in your life what exactly caused it?
Mm-hmm. And there are testimonials from some women where they said they've had the removal of their breast implant. They feel so much better. But that's anecdotal. Yeah. That's anecdotal.
Correct. So in the, you know, in the 90s, they were looking at this. There were enough reports, and then some of the patients got organized and came together, and there was just enough data that it was worth looking at. They actually had a moratorium on the implants, meaning they took them off the market entirely, and there was no silicone that was available to anyone. And that lasted about 15 years, and it was really thoroughly reviewed. And then they came back on the market because no one could make any definitive conclusions, and there was no definitive proof that there was a real problem worthy of keeping them off the market.
And why do silicone at all if there are potential issues associated with silicone when you can have saline implants and they're less associated with health problems?
So, you know, there's two parts to that answer. The first part is that, you know, silicone was originally chosen because it was always believed to be inert. So it was always believed that the body would have no response to it and no immune response in particular. It was always believed that you wouldn't have any bacteria that could grow inside the implant, and that it just was this kind of thing that doesn't do anything but sit there. So wouldn't it be a perfect thing to use? It also feels really soft and jelly-like, which simulates breast very well. And so a lot of it was the belief that it's totally innocuous and it doesn't do anything or provoke anything in the body. And then the second part of it is that the saline implants, the traditional ones, which are just one compartment, after a while, they, you know, especially depending on the size you use or how much breast tissue you have to cover it, they could start looking sort of like a water balloon. And so the silicone offered an aesthetic result that was believed to be superior. So when you take those two things
together. So you avoid the waterbed effect, you know.
Yeah, you know, they would, yeah, exactly. And so they believed, most surgeons believe that you got a better result, more natural feel, more natural look, and something that's totally inert. So why not use it?
Right. So fast forward to 2019, there are new concerns that have arisen. And I think this all started in Europe. Is that correct?
Yeah. So there are new and old concerns. So that's what's interesting about what's happening right now. So one of the things that happened when the silicone implants came back on the market is they made several what they believed to be improvements. And one of the main improvements was cohesive gel, meaning they took the same gel, but they linked the molecules together tighter. So you had something that was a little firmer, but it also was less runny as a gel. And that becomes relevant because if you have a rupture and the gel gets out, when it's runny and gooey and sticky, it's very, very difficult to clean up effectively. So these implants, this is what everyone came to start calling as gummy bear implants. So it's still a gel, it's still soft, but if it ever got cut, it would be more of a cut versus a tear that lets all this oozy stuff out.
Dr. Bartzi, how realistic is the prospect of rupture? Because, I mean, there are many internal organs of the body, you know, the liver, the spleen, that in, you know, a sports injury or a ski injury or certainly an automotive injury, a vehicular accident, can rupture. We know that. So we have a bag, essentially, that contains a material which has uncertain properties if released throughout the thoracic cavity, you know, which basically where it's implanted. How realistic is that prospect, and have you seen patients who've experienced ruptures?
I've definitely seen it. So, you know, when you put the implant in, the body will make a shell of scar tissue around it called a capsule. So everything that happens inside the capsule is still relatively contained in that capsule, but it's still in contact with the body. In terms of rupture rates, you know, we have the data that are reported by the main implant manufacturers, and they usually report their rates at about 10 years. You can look through their literature and get the rates further down the road. But around 10 years, you're looking at something around 15 to 20% on average. There is some variability.
Whoa. Wait a minute.
Yeah, that's pretty high.
I mean, if you were to get on a plane, say, a Boeing 737 to cite frequently, concerning example, and there was a 15% risk of plane malfunction, you wouldn't get on that plane. You're saying that a 10-year risk of rupture of 15% with the potential for seepage of some potentially caustic or immunoreactive material into the body?
Well, yeah, so that's the main issue, is that, you know, the reason why people have this number of 10 years in their head of when they have to replace their implants, it's not really an alarm clock. It's not a time bomb. These are all just statistical averages. And so what ends up happening is after about 10 years, the rupture rate gets, like you said, to a number that's a little bit uncomfortably high.
Yeah.
So that's why most people end up switching them out at some time before that, because after that, the numbers get more significant and then you have a really high chance of rupture. So, you know, in keeping with all these concerns with rupture, just going back to what we were talking about before, the cohesive gel, the initial iterations of that were shaped implants that were shaped like a teardrop because they were believed to potentially give you even better aesthetic effect. Maybe it'll look more natural.
Right.
But the problem with the shape...
You don't want that sort of perfect spherical appearance, because that's sort of a dead giveaway, right?
Right. And now, you know, you're going to have your own breast tissue that's going to dictate a certain amount of shape anyway. So even with a round implant, you can get a nice natural shape if you're fitted properly. Mm-hmm. But in an effort to kind of maximize this, one of the things they did is they made some anatomic implants. And in order for those implants to not turn within the pocket and look upside down, they made a textured coating on them that it would grab onto the tissue. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's a new concern now is we are learning that the texture on the implants is something that is probably to be concerned about. It has been linked to a very rare form of lymphoma. And this is one of the new issues. And
I think there have been over 400 documented cases of this rare lymphoma. I mean, lymphoma, relatively common cancer, but this is a subtype of lymphoma, which is unusual, right?
This is called ALCL.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And is it the material that they're using, or is it the chronic irritation that the texture may be causing, setting up an inflammatory reaction that affects the lymphatic system and ultimately leads to cancer?
It's believed to be the texturing.
Okay.
And they can even, you know, we've even tried to separate out the different types of texturing among different implant companies, and there are certain ones that seem to be slightly more high risk than others. So this is a real issue. There have been documented illnesses. There have been documented severe illnesses. In Europe, they are in the process of banning these textured implants, and I think I would support that. So this is part of the sort of new concerns. And then going back to the old concerns, which is the other very interesting part of this, is a lot of the old concerns are coming back as well in terms of autoimmune disease and people just not feeling well with their implants. So we actually have two different things that are going on in relation to the same devices.
Okay, so on the one hand, if I can summarize, this dire prospect of a very dangerous malignancy, but which is rare, but then it sort of puts the crosshairs back on breast implants once again to resurrect previous concerns about vague symptoms, autoimmune disorders that are hard to trace.
Right.
Right. So, okay. So you and your career with mm-hmm. cosmetic breast surgery, have you envisioned this? Have you been skeptical about some of these newer procedures and, you know, based on the evidence presented to you, said, this isn't ready for prime time?
Well, so, you know, one of the things that happened in my personal practice in the last several years is there was a point, I was using a lot of silicone for a long time. I really liked the way that it looked and felt. My patients were very happy with it. You know, then it got to a point where I started to see some of these patients who've had implants in for a very long time. And, you know, once they come out, they tend to feel better. It's not everybody. It's a small group of people, but it's a real thing that I've observed. And I remember saying to myself, you know, I wish there were a saline-based alternative that I felt could be aesthetically comparable, because I feel like there's something brewing and I'm not really sure what to make of it. And I think, you know, some of my colleagues would agree, there's something going on and it's still a little bit hard to define. So I definitely was looking into new kinds of options and, you know, other types of implants. And I found an implant called the Ideal Implant, which is...
What's it called? I'm sorry.
The Ideal Implant.
Ideal. Okay.
Yeah. It's a saline-based implant with multiple chambers and it holds a really nice shape that's not...
So you avoid the silicone connection.
You avoid the silicone connection, but you get a really good aesthetic result. And so I've been using a lot of that implant for exactly all those reasons. And the more experience I get and the more patients I treat and the more patients I treat who've had implants in for an extended period of time, the more I'm sort of, you know, starting to really feel that there's something going on. And like I said, you know, it's not everyone. There are millions of women with implants. There are a lot of them who are very happy and, you know, living their lives and not having a problem. But, you know, the way that I explain it to patients is if you give 100 people a glass of red wine, they're going to have 100 different responses. Mm-hmm. And I think it's and you can't predict that necessarily if they've never had that glass of wine before. So there are certain patients for whom they just don't tolerate the implants well. And the problem is that you wouldn't know until you try it.
So I have to go here, Dr. Bartz, and this sort of is the fundamental question. In 2019, what is the rationale for getting a breast implant in this era of female empowerment and, you know, the an effort to reduce body shaming and so on and so forth, self-acceptance? You know, these movements are well underway and should further women's acceptance of, you know, their God-given attributes. Under what circumstances might breast implants be important? You know, we can understand in cancer, for example, you know, we have reconstruction that's given to women as an option after breast removal, mastectomy. But what are some of the considerations here?
Well, one of the points I'd like to make in drawing, you know, a parallel between reconstruction and cosmetic augmentation is that there are cultures in which reconstruction is not acceptable, where they feel like just wanting to be reconstructed even after a bilateral mastectomy is vain. And I've had that happen, that I've had patients who were getting a lot of pressure from their family not to do any reconstruction because why should you care? And to that end,
so you have to be a little bit of a psychologist when you work with patients. And in fact, college major was psychology. It wasn't in it wasn't in the hard sciences of, you know, biology, chemistry, biochemistry, genetics. It was in psychology, which actually probably serves you in good stead, because there are a lot of psychological ramifications to making this decision when you work with patients.
It's a very big deal. And all of these surgeries, you know, these are journeys that you take with your patient. But, you know, I will emphatically and fiercely defend any woman's right to do whatever it is she feels she wants to do to feel comfortable in her skin and with her body. There's a lot of changes that happen even after pregnancy that can be, for some people, very mentally challenging and physically disabling. And I believe everyone should be able to put themselves back together and do what they need to do. But, you know, in answer to your question, as a general rule, when it comes to cosmetic surgery, which is something elective, and we have to remember that it's still surgery and it's still to be taken seriously, I think that anyone who is a good candidate for surgery within a reasonable margin of risk is a good candidate for surgery and should have the choice to do what they want. And I think in terms of devices they use, the procedure is only as good and as safe as the devices. But we have options. And I think it's important to understand all of them, understand everything that comes with all of them, and then make an informed choice for yourself. And it might not be the same choice for everyone. But I think the biggest mistake is not having the procedure done, but rather being sort of targeted to only one option and not understanding the whole picture and not making the choice with all the available information.
Well, you know, I guess in the context of modern sexual reassignment surgery, making a decision that if nature endowed you as a 32A, you prefer to identify as a 36D, may be a relatively minor alteration.
Correct.
Right. Yep. So... what are some of the different breast implant options available today? And what would you say to women who are faced with that choice? So you prefer the Ideal, it's the saline, but what are some of the other options that are still considered safe? And I guess we have to wait for the advisory from the FDA because hearings are being held this week.
That's correct. The hearings are today and tomorrow, so we'll see what comes of that. You know, no one knows what the final recommendations will be and whether there will be any devices that will no longer be favored or even potentially, you know, discussion about whether or not they should be on the market. But as a general rule, I would say, you know, saline still seems to be quite safe. I think as far as saline implants go, the Ideal to me represents an advance in technology. I like it very much, and I've had good experience with my patients. When it comes to silicone, I don't think we're in a place where we're saying all silicone's bad and evil and no one should ever use it. I do think that textured implants have proven to have a real problem. I would not recommend using those devices.
They're not going to be around. That's just not going to happen.
I don't think so. And then in terms of the silicone gel, I think the cohesive gel is a good option. I think it is better to have something that is going to, if it gets out of the shell, be easier to clean up and less of an issue and, you know, potentially might cause less of an inflammatory response, but we don't really know the answer to that. I think once the shell is cracked, you're still in contact with the silicone is still in contact with your tissues. So it's still something to think about. And, you know, the other issue is in terms of we're talking about this rate of rupture, you know, how do you determine whether or not the implant is ruptured? Because when a silicone gel implant ruptures, you can't really tell. It doesn't just get absorbed like saline would get absorbed. And that's another part of this is, you know, in the scheme of healthcare and expense and time and diagnosis and all of that, you know, they recommend getting MRIs every couple of years to check on the implant.
Oh, okay. Is this a standard practice? If you have a breast implant, you need to check in. There's some follow-up necessary.
Correct.
I didn't even know that. It's just, you know, you just like, you know, get them and use them and, you know, have a nice life. But no, actually, the responsible thing is to do some appropriate follow-up just to make sure that there's no leakage or some problem developing.
So the recommendation is an MRI every couple of years. And the issues with that are that usually you have to pay for that yourself. So that's something that you can't ignore that. That's an expense and it's a significant expense. Also getting an MRI, I don't know if you've ever had one, is not the most pleasant experience.
No.
Sort of in this little tube and it can be quite claustrophobic. But the other part of it though is that the MRI has always been considered the gold standard for silicone implant rupture. This is for silicone because for saline, it's not the same. The same thing. And in my experience, I've had a handful of patients who've had an MRI that said the implant was ruptured. And when we went to the operating room and took out the implant, it wasn't. I've also found that they're not always that reliable. Sometimes they're very helpful and sometimes they're not 100%. So you have to make a decision about surgery based on a test that may or may not be completely accurate. Mm-hmm. And that for me is very frustrating and kind of unsettling. It's a big decision to go back to the operating room.
Is there a limit to a number of re-implantation cycles that a woman can undergo? I mean, it's like you're saying that there's a lifetime for the implant and also the shape of the breast, the woman's body contours may change. You may undergo several implants during a lifetime. Is that
That's a fair assessment? Yeah, most patients will not end up with the same ones they started with. And that's a general rule. That's usually the case. There isn't really a defined number. You know, you've had five and now you're done. You got one more and then that's it.
Yeah.
There are some people who unfortunately have had multiple operations, but every time, it's like anything else, every time you go back in, you risk having more scar tissue, you risk getting an infection, you risk having some other kind of problem. It's a lot of manipulation. So you don't want to have to operate multiple times on the same person. Unfortunately, sometimes that does happen for one reason or another.
Okay. Well, you know, this has been most informative, and we have more to talk about because we want to talk about alternatives to breast implants because there are some. We also want to talk about breast surgery on men. which you're an expert on as well. It may seem implausible. We're not talking about breast implants. We're talking about quite the opposite. And some considerations in terms of, you know, how you approach a patient and how you create a good outcome and a realistic outcome from women who are desirous of making that cosmetic change. So we're going to talk about that in part two. Our guest is Dr. Sophie Bartzisch. Dr. Bartzisch, you want to give out information about, you have a website as well, right?
Yes, my website is drsophie.com, spelled out drsophie.com. And there's a lot of information on breast surgery and also other types of aesthetic surgery that I do.
And you practice in Manhattan, but you do have patients who come from all over the country and all over the world, in fact. And yes. You also offer the additional benefit that you're bilingual. So you see in French,
yes.
You attended the Lycée Français in New York, which is a really cool private school here in New York where kids learn in English and French. And a lot of kids of diplomats and, you know, from foreign nationalities go there. It's a great place to send your kids to school. And yes. So do you have French patients who come to see
yes,
you?
Yes, I do. French is actually my first language, and it's a big part of my cultural background and also just sort of how I see the world. It's a very international lens that I carry. And for some patients, that's very important and one of their priorities.
Mm-hmm. So when women want to go topless in Saint-Tropez, they come to see you, right?
That's right.
Okay, because that's the real test of a successful cosmetic intervention is
exactly
the beach of Nice or Cannes. Okay, I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest, Dr. Sophie Bartzisch. We'll be back for more on the subject of cosmetic breast surgery in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine podcast. We'll be right back.